The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, and 24/7 support. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer code Guardian to get 10% off.
Hello, this is Politics Weekly, and I'm Anne Perkins. Opposition parties rarely make the political weather on any issue, and especially not on foreign policy. But a key intervention earlier this year in the parliamentary debate on a possible intervention in Syria can plausibly be said to have altered history. David Cameron lost the vote, the US had second thoughts about going in, and Ed Miliband took the plaudits. Now Labour's shadow Foreign Secretary Douglas Alexander has put pen to paper on a range of global issues in a new book, Influencing Tomorrow. Last week, he came into The Guardian and spoke to our columnist Jonathan Friedland, who began by asking him why he chose this year to release it.
If we were simply to read a cross-section of the British media, you would think the only foreign policy issue, apart from periodic crises, was the reach of Brussels. I wasn't convinced that was the case. I think the generational story is actually the rise of Beijing. And so I brought together a range of thinkers from around the world to try and together deliberate on what will be the challenges that any government would face in 2015, looking at the decade ahead.
And it's hard to distill a long and thoughtful book like this, but what are some of the more arresting conclusions that these people you asked to write came up with?
That probably the two central pillars of British foreign policy, on one hand the transatlantic relationship, on the other hand membership of the European Union, are coming under strain. On one hand from a consolidation within the Eurozone, and on the other hand from a United States that's pivoting now towards Asia. And therefore to simply carry on as if nothing has changed or to try and bury one's head in the sand simply doesn't make sense for the United Kingdom. If the United Kingdom still aspires to be a country that can help with others shape and influence the world of tomorrow, then that demands new approaches.
I mean, you were involved in the foreign policy of the last Labour government because you were Secretary of State for International Development. You had a seat at that table. Do you imagine that the foreign policy of the next Labour government, if it comes into office in 2015, which you dearly hope it will be radically different, noticeably different from the Labour government you were part of last time?
I think, for example, there would be a greater consciousness of Asia's rise. I think it is a truth that we are living through a generational shift, not just of wealth, but also of power globally. And the challenges, therefore, confronting a Labour government in 2015 would be fundamentally different from 1995 or indeed from 2005.
But what would that translate into? Would it mean that we'd see Labour being perhaps less robust on human rights in China and saying, look, the real world is China's number one on the planet, we're going to have to bend the knee?
No, I don't see that at all. On the other hand, I think it's fair to recognise that the government that came into office in 2010, the Conservatives, who said bilateral relationships, for example, with China are going to be absolutely key, haven't managed those bilateral relationships very well. At the same time, I would argue, the present government's approach to multilateralism is pretty much a blank sheet of paper. And I do think one of the hallmarks of a Labour government in the future would be a serious and sustained commitment to multilateralism. So whether it is an Asia consciousness, whether it is a commitment to multilateralism, whether it is a commitment to reform within Europe rather than exit from Europe, I think the contours of that approach are already clear.
I want to come on to Europe in the course of our conversation, but just the whole business of you putting out a book on foreign policy now. There was a time when nobody would have paid any attention to any opposition on foreign policy. And suddenly, actually, Labour in opposition is making some of the weather in foreign policy terms. And what I'm particularly thinking of is that vote in the House of Commons at the end of the summer on Syria.
Sure.
Would you say that was the most important foreign policy decision ever by any opposition?
I think in terms of the impact of that decision, it has certainly proved to be very significant. You don't need to take my word for it. Look at the words that Barack Obama used in explaining why he was deciding not to take immediate military action, but instead to send the decision to the Congress in the United States. I think it would be disingenuous for anybody who cast their vote that Thursday night in the House of Commons to say with any certainty they could have predicted that the diplomatic path would subsequently open up the way it has in relation to chemical weapons. But all of us should be grateful that that's exactly what did happen. And in that sense, I don't in any way resile from the votes that we cast. And I think if the Labour Party had not taken the stance that we had, then I think there would have been military action that weekend.
So you're being quite honest. You're not trying to overclaim and say it was because of Labour's vote that we've got this now diplomatic route, which appears to have borne fruit because the Syrians have apparently complied with the first of these deadlines on chemical weapon disarmament. You're not claiming credit for that. But there will be some people who will think actually that was a fateful decision for Labour, because it could have very easily gone the other way, that President Assad could have read that and interpreted that as there's never going to be military action. That's how what David Cameron said straight afterwards. I get it, we're not going to do military action, and therefore I've got a green light and I've got a free hand. Mm. Would that have been on your conscience, on Labour's conscience, if it had worked out that way?
Well, by definition, that's now hypothetical. I think it's fair to recognise whether you're the government or the opposition when you cast those votes. You're not making a decision with the benefit of hindsight. We had to carefully weigh and calibrate the judgment that we made. I believe that we made the right judgment, but I certainly don't think there should be any triumphalism. I think that there was a course of action that was avoided. There was a new path that's opened up, but the suffering in Syria continues. It is truly horrific, the numbers of refugees, the numbers of people still being killed. And in that sense, I hope that the international community will, if you like, draw strength and common purpose from the progress that's being made on chemical weapons to now buttress that agreement and build on that agreement towards Geneva II, a restarting of a broader set of discussions about finding a resolution to the conflict.
And you said no triumphalism, and yet there were some Labour MPs cheering when that vote happened. There was Ed Miliband himself was cheered when he went into the Commons tea room afterwards. Some people felt, even people within the Labour family, that left a bad taste in the mouth, given what had prompted that Commons debate, which was death of civilians, including many children, by chemical weapons.
I was one of the people you're referring to. I don't think the Commons brings any credit upon itself when it appears to diminish the significance of the issues. And there are no issues that are of greater significance than issues of life and death, whether you're putting British servicemen and women in harm's way or whether you're casting a vote that will inevitably, whichever way you cast that vote, have consequences for lives and communities across Syria and the Middle East.
So you're pretty clear you were voting against military action that weekend rather than military action per
se. We set out a framework for decision. We were not saying in no circumstances will we ever contemplate military action. But what do I believe honestly happened that week? I think the President got on the phone to the British Prime Minister on the Sunday afternoon and said, are you with me? We're going to take military action imminently. And I think the Prime Minister said yes. And essentially what happened between the Sunday afternoon and the votes on the Thursday was an attempt to shoehorn a timetable for legitimacy into a pre-prescribed timetable for credibility. And I think that the Prime Minister would have been frankly wiser on that Sunday afternoon rather than, as I think he did, give a commitment that Britain would be alongside the Americans in taking immediate military action in those days ahead. Why else would the House of Commons have been recalled just 3 days before Parliament was due back after its summer recess? He would have been far wiser to say, listen, there are steps that Britain has to take in order to be able to take military action. That involves the weapons inspectors being allowed to complete their work. That involves going to the Security Council and having a vote on the Security Council to exhaust the multilateral processes. Alas, I don't think those explanations were offered to the President. The Prime Minister then felt he had given a personal undertaking to the President, and that was just the first of a catalogue of errors that we saw from the government in those days.
Let's move on to what has become, in some ways, the big foreign policy issue of the autumn, and that is this surveillance by the National Security Agency and its partners in GCHQ in Britain, a story that partly broken by The Guardian, but The New York Times, Washington Post and others have run with it too. It's made huge waves around the world, as you know, but everyone from the present on down in America saying there's some serious questions here to answer. John Kerry, you know, and others talking about reviewing perhaps the way surveillance works. Why has Labour, official Labour, not former Labour ministers, but today's Labour Party, not been one of the voices speaking loudly about surveillance that may appear to have got out of hand?
Well, firstly, the Americans have to speak for themselves. They've got their own legal framework, their own framework of accountability. And there is and has been a different approach taken in the United Kingdom. The Intelligence and Security Committee has said that it's going to review all of these matters. I've seen that one of my colleagues, David Blunkett, in recent days has made clear he wants RIPA to be looked at as part of that review.
But RIPA being the legislation that covers
a lot of this. And in that sense, that's perfectly appropriate for the ISC to look at. But there is a process that's underway. If I recollect, the heads of the agencies are going to be in front of a public hearing of the ISC in the days ahead. So in that sense, there are processes that are underway in the United Kingdom to look at exactly these issues.
Yeah, but that's a pretty sort of detached view, isn't it? And process heavy. There's an in-principle point here, isn't there? Which is, and I take your point, you can't talk about the Americans, but here's GCHQ. The documents are pretty clear that it's been engaged in this mass surveillance of regular people's emails, metadata, phone calls, etc. Labour, surely you'd expect the opposition to have a view on that. There's a threat to civil liberties there, isn't it?
And a responsible opposition recognises that what matters actually is the policy, because that's what will determine what is the appropriate balance between liberty and security. And in that sense, if you're saying, why are you not playing politics, why are you focusing on the policy, then I plead guilty, because the policy is ultimately...
No, but calling for a change in the policy.
Because the policy is ultimately both the guarantor for the citizen in terms of privacy and the right checks and balances being in place, and also the basis on which the citizenry can also feel confident in the conduct of the agencies.
But do you feel the policy is right at the moment, or does it need a change?
Well, it's being reviewed and is being looked at, and it's perfectly appropriate that that should happen, given the very widespread concern that's emanated from the revelations within The Guardian and the other newspapers that have published this evidence. But what matters is not simply the process of scrutiny, but also reviewing whether the policy is appropriate. And that obviously is related in the sense that what is revealed has to be considered, discussed, deliberated upon. But if you're saying, am I making instant judgments as to how the policy needs to change, I'm not.
But you would like the IC to look at changing the policy, looking to a review of the policy to see whether it's right now.
They need to review all of the evidence and reach a considered judgment that will inform the position that the government takes. And as the opposition, of course, we will reach a view.
Yeah, and you've got full confidence in the IC. I mean, some people think that the fact that its members are handpicked by, nominated by the Prime Minister, admittedly ratified by Commons later, but it is an unusual body. It doesn't answer solely to Parliament. It has this executive control over it too. You're confident that's the right body? You trust their judgment?
I'm not impugning the integrity of my fellow parliamentarians on all sides. They've got a serious job of work to do, but they've got a very important job to do as well, because they act on behalf of elected representatives of all political parties who in turn represent the citizens of the United Kingdom. So in that sense, I take very seriously their work. I've not seen evidence that the work that they are doing is compromised in any way, and I think that those who are alleging that the IFC is not the appropriate body are not correct. I think, of course, we should continue to consider whether the IFC in its present formulation is able to do all of the work that needs to be done. But as I say, I'm not going to rush to instant judgment on this. I think there are processes that we should follow.
And before we leave this, your constituents, should they be worried by what they've heard and has been revealed about the privacy and security of their own
certainly
data?
I've had contact with constituents who have told me that they're worried. And in that sense, part of the task, the vital task of our intelligence agencies, is contingent upon sustaining the consent and support of the British public. And for that reason, as well as for reasons of that delicate and necessary balance between liberty and security, it's important that there are continuing efforts made. I think while the intelligence agencies have a responsibility, while the Intelligence and Security Committee has a responsibility, there's also a heavy burden of responsibility on ministers. Because actually, we should not have expectations that agency heads are essentially public figures continually advocating on their own behalf. That's the rightful job of the ministers overseeing those departments. And in that sense, I think there's a heavy burden of responsibility on William Hague, on Theresa May, on the Prime Minister, to be explaining what most people accept are very difficult judgments, so that exactly those constituents of mine and others who have very real concerns in light of the revelations that have emerged can have those questions answered.
There have been some questions raised in Parliament, not about the content of the revelations, but about The Guardian for revealing them, saying that The Guardian shouldn't have done that, that it was in some ways threatening or compromising national security. What's your view on that?
Listen, I'm not privileged to the information. I don't have access to the information that either The Guardian had in its possession or that
the agencies
have. You've
seen the stuff The Guardian has published.
Yes, and as I say, I'm not in a position to judge the extent to which that has compromised individual investigations that were underway or individual approaches. But listen, there's a heavy responsibility on the government both to make sure that systems are secure where information is contained. And in that sense, I think that the primary responsibility moving forward rests with the government to make sure that they're offering both the assurances that are required and the explanations that are needed.
Did The Guardian do the right thing publishing this story?
it's for the Guardian to make those judgments, not for politicians. Indeed, I think, Jonathan, you would probably be the first person
sure.
to suggest that you wouldn't want a politician prejudging the decisions of an independent
no,
editor.
No, but given politicians...
In fact, I think you've written columns to that effect on many occasions.
But given that politicians are out there condemning us for doing it, it would be quite good if Labour politicians came out and said, look, this is... first of all, there is a free press, but also it's been a useful debate.
Listen,
that the Guardian
I believe started. In the free press. I don't think it would do the Guardian any favours and the Labour Party any favours to suggest that we had a particular responsibility to the Guardian or to any other publication. It's for the Guardian to justify their conduct. It's for politicians to justify ours.
Yeah, but a welcome debate. It's good. It's a good thing this debate has started.
The debate is inevitable given the technological changes that are happening. And in that sense, I think the right course is not to rush to instant judgment, but instead to use appropriate processes to make sure that the right systems are in place.
I promised you before, and I wouldn't want to disappoint, that we would come on to Europe, and you rightly pointed out that it's often an obsession, the only foreign policy issue some people talk about, but we should talk about it a bit. I mean, people have been reporting there is a discussion even within Labour, around the shadow cabinet table, about a referendum. There's David Cameron, who has committed to having a referendum if he wins the next election. Obviously, that's a big if, but in 2017. And some say it would be quite smart for Labour to either get in ahead of that, promise one before, or just to sort of neutralise that promise by saying, OK, we'll have one too. I mean, partly you're going to wear a hat as a political strategist. Mm. Interested to hear what you think on that score. But also just on the principle of it, it has been a long time, not since 1975, that the British people have been consulted, if you like, had a vote on our involvement in the European Union, then the common market. What's your view on whether Labour should say, yep, the British people should also have their say?
Well, that's a decision that has to be made on the national interest. Labour's never been opposed in principle to giving the British people referendums. For example, we've made clear that we would support the Sovereignty Act, which is on the statute book at the moment, which means if there is a significant transfer of sovereignty from Britain to Brussels, there will be a referendum. I think what we also have to recognise, honestly, though, both with our political hats on and looking at the policy, David Cameron didn't wake up at the beginning of February with a sudden democratic impulse. He was driven to the speech that he made by weakness. And we have taken a view and continue to hold the view around the shadow cabinet table that not only is this a decision that has to be based on the national interest, but we're not convinced that to commit now to an in-out referendum in 2017, the policy of David Cameron, is correct for a country that is struggling to sustain and build economic growth, that still has significantly high levels of unemployment.
Because it's a diversion of energy.
And that needs reform in Europe. I'm also, you know, I'm very clear that David Cameron's position that he's adopted just isn't smart diplomacy, never mind being a sign of political weakness.
You said not now. I mean, should I interpret that as being that absent a transfer of extra sovereignty to the European Union, there's no situation that Labour would actually call for a referendum?
Well, fine.
In
we don't
referendum.
Know how Europe is going to change in the months and years ahead. You know, we've just seen the re-election of Chancellor Merkel. The indications emerging from those coalition discussions in Berlin is that it's much less likely that there will be fundamental treaty change than people anticipated back in February.
Absent that kind of change, there's no reason why Labour would call for a referendum.
Well, listen, we're not convinced that to commit now to an in-out referendum makes sense.
Or even commit later.
Well, listen, as I say, I can't anticipate every possible change in the European Union in the future. Europe is changing. We all recognise that. We've made clear that if there's a significant transfer of sovereignty, there'll be a referendum. That remains our position.
But you can see the political appeal of it, and I take your point about national interest, but it would neutralise, it would shoot their fox a bit, wouldn't it?
Well, listen, you've got to reach a judgment like this, not on the basis of which folks you can shoot, but what's the national interest. I think that's part of the reason David Cameron finds himself in the difficulties that he's in. I think he was thinking, how can I shoot this fox? And he ended up fattening this fox. You know, UKIP's support, I think, reflects a range of very challenging issues, not just, frankly, for the Conservative Party, but for politicians of all political hues. But it is in character essentially more an anti-politics vote than an anti-Europe vote. And for David Cameron to think that he can somehow remove any risk to the Conservatives from UKIP by pledging a referendum, well, it hasn't worked out so well so far.
You do have this unusual role because that I've referred to. You do wear these two hats. Labour often criticises the Chancellor, George Osborne, as being a part-time Chancellor. He can't possibly be in charge of election strategy and be Chancellor. How can you possibly be Shadow Foreign Secretary and in charge of election strategy at the same time? Aren't you therefore doing both jobs part-time?
Alas, I don't have a major government ministry to run that's affecting the lives, opportunities and economic prosperity of millions of my fellow citizens. And in that sense, I think it's hardly a secret that there's a different set of responsibilities in opposition from that in government. But in terms of the work that we
did... being shadow foreign secretary is lighter as a workload than being chancellor.
The nature of opposition is different from the day-to-day responsibility of not just running a department, but making major decisions in relation to forward planning on policy. Now, of course, opposition carries a heavy burden of responsibility in terms of scrutiny. I think if you look, for example, at the work that we did on Syria, few would doubt that we were had anything other than our eye on the ball in relation to what were difficult and important decisions. We will continue to do that, and I will continue to do that in terms of foreign affairs. One of the reasons I wrote this book was because it's both a professional responsibility but a personal passion. I'm fascinated by how the world is going to change, because if I look at my own constituency of Paisley, whether that is where the jobs of the future are going to come from, you know, the whiskey bottling plant in Paisley, its largest export market is China. Last week, we lost 143 jobs to South Korea when a chemical plant closed. Globalization is reaching into communities right across this country. And if you are with integrity to be able to offer a politics of hope and a clear program for the future, then that traditional boundary between domestic policy and foreign policy is breaking down.
Let's get on to the election planning that you're currently engaged in. The numbers are good for Labour, but they're not stellar in the sense that what a lot of the conventional wisdom is that actually an opposition to really be sure of winning a majority needs to be in double-digit poll leads. Even some people say, you know, healthy, strong 15, 16% type leads to allow for the whittling and converging that happens when you get into an election campaign. Labour's sort of in the single digits, the fives, the sevens, the nines. It's good, no one's taking away from that, but is it enough for you to feel that this election, you can feel confident about 2015?
Well, listen, of course I want to see increasing number of voters and increasing poll share for Labour. You wouldn't expect me to say anything else, but I fear that your question has revealed outrage. You know, we came to political reporting or political involvement in eras of long political cycles involving two political parties. The Tories in from 79 to 97, Labour 97 to 2010. I think one of the challenges that our generation faces is recognising that that's not actually a very good guide to politics looking to the next decade. And I would say that for a couple of reasons. First of all, I think in some ways it feels more akin to the electoral context of the 1970s, an era of relatively low economic growth and high electoral volatility, where there was, if you like, a willingness to change governments more rapidly than we saw in the 80s, 90s or early noughties. But I think there's also a point here, which is, as a Scot, I'm used to four-party politics. All of my political life, I've seen the Scottish National Party as a fixed part of the constellation of political forces in Scotland. I think there is at least an argument that what we are seeing in England now is the advent of a four-party politics. And in that sense, with UKIP emerging onto the national stage, we will oppose them vigorously, and I imagine other parties will as well.
But the days
actually
of 20
some
point.
Of the assumptions that actually there is an automaticity between a vote for Labour, a vote for Tories, might not prove to be as true in the future as it was in the past.
And therefore, these big whacking majorities and four and poll leads in the teens may just be a thing of the past in four-party politics.
Again, if you look at traditional tribal loyalty, either to the Conservative Party or the Labour Party, for decades it's been tracking downwards. In that sense, we saw back in 1992 John Major's re-election, a very significant Conservative vote, the highest vote for many, many decades. But that really was the exception. And in that sense, our challenge is, as the Labour Party, to buck the historic trend that once we go into opposition, as we did in 2010, that it takes us two or three electoral cycles to come back. I'm not saying that we will definitively win this election. I'm not complacent, but this is a winnable election, and this is a bad government that deserves to lose.
One of the obstacles that the polling reveals, and it does suggest this is highly winnable for Labour, but one of them is this measure, which, and we could debate about how decisive it is, but the, if you like, the presidential test. And on the, you know, who is the best place to be prime minister measure, even when Labour as a party is ahead, Ed Miliband is behind David Cameron quite substantially on that. Now, you may say that leaders don't matter, we don't live in a presidential system, but people, when they came to cast their ballots, at least one of the questions in their mind is, who do I want to put in number 10? Does it worry you that still after 3.5 years, more or less people coming to now a fixed view of Ed Miliband, they feel he's less suited to being Prime Minister than the man who's already in the
job? Well, I know Ed, and I think he'll be an effective Prime Minister. But let me take one point from the past and make one point about the future. The point from the past is, look at 1979. We were talking earlier about the 1970s. You know, Jim Callaghan consistently outperformed Margaret Thatcher in who made the best prime minister in all published polling up until the 1979 election. But it didn't stop a government losing office and the leader of the opposition in turn becoming the prime minister. If the Conservatives were anything like as confident as they suggest in relation to leadership as we look ahead to the general election, then I've got a very basic challenge for them. Let's have some television debates during the short campaign. Because my real fear is, for all of their bluster about their confidence about their man, they will work very hard to avoid exactly the television debates that we saw in the 2010 general election. And of course, from a Labour point of view, I want an opportunity, a platform for Ed Miliband to be able to show his stuff and to perform and to make his case as a prospective Prime Minister to the people of the United Kingdom. But as a citizen of the United Kingdom, I also think that they've got a right to expect that people who aspire to be the Prime Minister put themselves up for scrutiny during the short campaign in television debates.
And you'd be happy with those, even if it is Clegg, Cameron and Miliband, because then it's two against one. I mean, that's an odd dynamic, because he'll be attacking government policy and you've got two people there defending it.
That's one of the reasons it would be fascinating to watch, because in some ways, psychologically, Clegg has a big interest in identifying with David Cameron. That's what he's been doing by that stage for 5 years, from the Rose Garden onwards. Cephalogically, in terms of the polling, all of his interest is to side with Ed Miliband against David Cameron, because if you look at where the Liberal Democrats are most vulnerable, the Conservatives are in second place in most of their seats. Now, that's ultimately a judgment Nick Clegg would have to make, but it's one of the reasons I would hope that we will see these debates and see the judgment that he reaches.
So you could have an I agree with Ed moment in that debate.
Who knows? Anything is possible.
So you would like to see those debates. In terms of your own role, I've heard it unkindly pointed out, and so I want to give you a chance to bat it back, that the last campaign you ran was for Ed's brother, David Miliband, and that didn't work out so well. So why should we be confident that you can do a better job this time?
Well, listen, I don't resile from the role that I played in David's campaign. He's still a good friend of mine, and I was proud to play the role that he asked me to play. But in that sense, I think, you know, the nature and character of a general election campaign is fundamentally different from an internal leadership battle within the Labour Party. And in that sense, when Ed asked me to take on this role, I was confident there was a contribution that I could make.
And some people have said that you've made the transition with such conviction that I read just the other day that you are the only Milibandite around the shadow cabinet table. So strong is your loyalty. Others still have our past loyalties, but your loyalty is very much to Ed Miliband. First of all, tell me if you think that's true, and if it is, how have you been able to make that move? Because you were, you know, there with Gordon Brown, and you did run David Miliband's campaign, and now very strongly with Ed.
At a pretty fundamental level, I don't care about these labels, partly because we've left behind an era of Blair Brown. The principal politicians have left the stage. The policy challenges are different. And frankly, we're in opposition. We were in government during those New Labour years. But, you know, I joined the Labour Party in 1982. The formative experiences for me of Labour activism were not of triumphant New Labour success. It was a bitter and repeated defeat for Labour in the community that I grew up in and that I now represent. So in that sense, I joined the Labour Party before I'd met Gordon Brown or Tony Blair.
In the era of Michael Foot.
I'd met David Miliband before I'd met Gordon Brown or Tony Blair. So I've always had a healthy scepticism about these labels. I plead guilty to being a Labour man. I am committed because I believe, for all of its faults, the Labour Party remains the principal vehicle for delivering social justice for the community that I represent.
So just give us a sneak preview in our final couple of answers now, a sneak preview of election strategy. I think we've seen some of it, that it's going to be about the cost of living and the standard of living that's been so squeezed now. But what do you feel, in a way, beyond that, or what more can you say about that, is going to be the key strategy in your campaign?
I think it's fair to say that the economy is going to be the centrepiece of this election. I think it is likely to be the first election in many, many decades when people will be worse off at the end of the parliament than they were at the beginning. And I think all of us in all political parties will have to respond effectively to that challenge. But I think the challenge is not just immediate in terms of cost of living, it's also longer term. I kind of think of this campaign in terms of somebody wearing bifocal glasses. Many constituents have immediate concerns.
Talking about revealing our age
there. Yes, exactly. But many of our constituents have immediate concerns through the bottom lenses. How do we pay for the petrol? How do we pay for the weekly shopping? And how do we manage the electricity bills? Can we afford a foreign holiday? So people have very immediate concerns in relation to cost of living, and Labour needs to have effective answers to those challenges. At the same time, I think people are also worried, saying, are my kids going to be living with me when they're 40? Will my kids have a career, or will they just have a series of short-term, low-paying jobs? How's Britain going to earn its living and pay its way in the world? And to come back to the book, the reason that I co-authored this book was to try and make sure that I had done some of the heavy lifting of thinking through how do we actually deliver a Britain not just of social justice but of rising prosperity in a radically changed global environment in the coming decade.
And you're going to ask the Ronald Reagan question, are you better off now than you were 5 years ago?
Well, as I recollect it, it worked pretty effectively for Ronald Reagan back in 1980 and 1979 when he posed the question. In that sense, I think that's a question that will haunt David Cameron every day of this campaign.
And any worries that you've peaked too early? Because you're raising all these questions now.
That's a very nice question to be faced.
I mean, you know, the energy freeze, obviously, you know, credit to Ed Miliband there. That intervention in his speech at the party conference in October or end of September has dominated politics throughout the autumn. But that would be great if the general election was next April or May, but it's another year after that. It's 18 months away. I mean, you can't keep this up, surely.
Listen, I'm in politics not just to change governments, but to change lives. People are struggling at the moment in communities right across Britain. And the fact that the Labour Party heard those voices, listened to those concerns and responded is a source of pride and not worry to me. We've got 18 months to lay out our case and to make our case to the people of Britain that notwithstanding the tough choices that any government would face, there is a better way, there's a fairer way that we can together prosper in the future. I think the initiative that Ed took at the party conference in relation to energy prices reflects a continuing commitment on his part to hear those voices, reflect those concerns, and then not just amplify anger, but offer real answers. That's what we're going to do over the next 18 months.
Douglas Alexander, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And that was The Guardian's Jonathan Friedland with the Shadow Foreign Secretary Douglas Alexander. Join us next week for an exclusive interview with the political scientist and author David Runciman. That's all we've got time for now. The producer was Phil Maynard. I'm Anne Perkins. Thanks for listening.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag-and-drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today, no credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you'll get 10% off your new account by using the offer code GUARDIAN.